Okay, thank you everyone for coming.
The Philanthropist Affiliated Society was founded in 2006 and hosts reading groups, public fora, and journalism investigating the death of the left. It's the old left in the 20s and 30s, the new left 60s and 70s, and the post-political left 80s and 90s. Perhaps we can now add the millennial left. We have chapters on university campuses around the world, predominantly in America, but also here in Europe, in Germany, Greece, Austria, Denmark, and here in London we have chapters at LSE, here at Goldsmiths. We've also got chapters in Manchester and Sheffield. Our reading group, which runs for 40 weeks throughout the years, going from radical bourgeois philosophy through to the Frankfurt School, is hosted on Tuesday nights in this building. And if you want the room details, please speak to Sophia, who's over there, at 6 p.m. on Tuesday nights. Our reading group at LSE is also on Tuesday nights, and if you're interested in details, please speak to Dominic, who's at the back. We also have coffee breaks at LSE on Friday, where we discuss contemporary articles from the left. If you're interested more in finding out more about Platypus, please go to platypus1917.org, or you can check out our Facebook page, Platypus Goldsmiths. We're very pleased to welcome a distinguished guest of panellists who are chair and moderator Padraig will introduce shortly, and we hope you enjoy the event. Thank you for coming.
So thank you all for being here. Corbyn, Sanders, Trump, Brexit, and the Gilets Jaunes, among others, have all claimed the mantle of democracy. But what does it mean for the left? Our panel will be held on the eve of the planned, at the moment, as you of course know, this is not happening now, date of the UK's exit from the European Union. This panel will be part of an international series put on by the Platypus on the same theme, addressing the democratic movements which have been taken up by both the left and the right in recent years. And then there were a series of questions which the panelists were asked to respond to, but considering in their responses. So I shall now, without further ado, introduce our panelists. So starting from the far left,
thank you.
Marge Mayo used to teach at Goldsmiths and is... I cannot read the front of his handwriting. Chairs of the...
That's my budget.
Okay, yeah.
Vice chair of
the educational program at the Marx Memorial Library. Yes. Then next Marge is James Hartfield, who is an independent author and co-editor on Spike magazine. James's immediate right is Adam Buick, who is a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And then finally we have Benjamin Studebaker, who's a PhD candidate at Cambridge University, and runs the podcast What's Left. So, without further ado, our panelists will have 12 minutes to give their presentations, followed by a couple of minutes each to sort of ask questions to each other, and then we will open up an audience Q&A. So,
For the purpose of the live stream, for people that are watching internationally, can everyone speak up a little bit? Because we have people watching in different countries. Yeah.
So without further ado, Marge, you'd like to begin?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll have a go. Thanks very much indeed for asking me here. We've got the questions, and I'm going to try and stick to the questions. I think they're actually very complicated questions. And I've only got some very simple answers. But anyway, here we go. The first question, have you all had the questions, by the way?
Yeah.
The first one is about the relationship between democracy and the working class today. and whether struggles for democracy by workers are the medium by which they got assimilated, or were they necessary anyway? I think this raises two questions before you even start. Which is how we define democracy, and then of course how we define the working class. I think democracy to me embraces very different kinds, far more representative and much more participative, including direct forms of democracy. But I think if the concept is to mean that people have power to affect their lives, then that has to include industrial democracy, democracy in the workplace, as well as political, social, legal, very important, and cultural aspects of people's lives. And that has to include personal and community relationships. In other words, the personal is political, and those kind of power relationships also have to be democratized. And then when it comes to the working class, of course, also contested, I think if we're going to take a Marxist, which I am, rather than a Weberian definition, then obviously class depends on relationships of production, and that includes the many, not the few. It certainly includes academics. If you think about how we sell, or how I used to sell my labour power, not in the same way as manual workers, you might say, but actually, given the kind of contracts that an awful lot of people are on, maybe not as differently as all that. People here be only too aware of that, I think. So on the basis of that, I think the answer to the first question is that despite the fact that there have been past gains, the working class has been absolutely massively under attack in terms of their political, social, cultural rights. And they've been essential to class struggle. If you think about the loss of democratic rights and how it's affected class struggle in recent years, particularly from the Thatcher years, you think about trade union legislation. I was reading about the Shrewsbury pickets in 1972. I think the three ended up spending more time in prison actually under New Labour than they did under the Tories. But the effect of that on solidarity action, I think, has been absolutely massive. The answer to the first question is massively under attack, but absolutely central to organising. So the next question is about is it a necessity to eschew established forms of mass politics in favour of new forms in order to build a democratic movement? I think that's a very complicated question, actually. If it means that traditional forms of democracy, as practiced in the so-called old social movements, like trade unions and so on, are irrelevant, the kind of Gortz, farewell to the working class sort of line, then my answer is emphatically no, actually, because I think both those more traditional forms of democracy and more participative direct forms of democracy can both have their place. I'm also very mindful of that old feminist trope about the tyranny of structurelessness, which we might want to talk about some more, just as I'm very mindful of the problems with populism. It's a very nice John Dryden quote that I came across the other day, some centuries ago. "Nor is the people's judgment always true. The most may err as grossly as the few." We've seemed to kind of encapsulate quite a few things. Next question is also difficult. Am I doing all right for time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why has democracy emerged as the primary demand of spontaneous forms of discontent? Is it necessary or adequate to deal with the pathologies of the period? I'm not sure if this is the case, actually, but I'm sure people will tell me that it is the case in terms of spontaneous demands of popular movements, because I think there are an awful lot of other demands about much more immediate issues about peace and war, about health and so on. But I do think that this comes out of a period of massive feelings of frustration and alienation and anxiety. There's an exhibition of The Scream that includes The Scream, isn't there, which in a way just typifies the anxiety and frustration of our age. And unsurprising, given the pressures on people's lives as a result of neoliberal globalisation, financialisation, the politics of austerity, from where I see it, traditional social democratic parties have absolutely failed to respond to this situation, not only in Britain but much more widely. And that means if formal political parties are failing to represent, then this massive cynicism, disengagement and democratic deficit. So no wonder if people are asking for democracy or more control over their lives. It's not really surprising. Is it enough to deal with the pathologies of our age? Well, absolutely not. But it's a start, because if you're not even able to engage people and build a movement in the face of all these increasing inequalities and the politics of austerity, I think that's a problem. Right, the next question. Engels wrote that a revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. Do you agree? Well, it certainly works for the Russian Revolution, doesn't it? And it works for the French Revolution as well. Does that mean that that's necessarily so for all times in the 21st century? I don't think that follows necessarily at all. If you're concerned with social transformation after a seizure of state power, then are social relationships also being transformed? And if not, is that the kind of revolution that any of us really interested in? I was trying to remember who said, if I can't dance, it's not my revolution. I think it was Emma Goldman, the anarchist. But why would we want a revolution in which people take decisions about us without us? I can't see it. Having said that, though, I can't imagine that any of us have any illusions about the resistance to be anticipated. If you just look at the media, when there's the remotest possibility of a Corbyn government here, the idea, I mean, even under the Wilson government, there was a plot of the generals, wasn't there, for God's sake? So I'm sure nobody does have illusions about the challenges to be faced. Next question is democracy oppressive or can it be? And how would you judge Lenin's formulation that democracy is also a state and that consequently democracy will also disappear when the state disappears? I'm not sure where that comes from, but anyway, it's a very interesting formulation. I think the answer to the first part maybe isn't so complicated, because of course democratic forms can be hijacked. As you can see in the way that far-right movements can manipulate. I've already mentioned the tyrannies of structurelessness and how what seem to be democratic forms can actually be manipulated. And majorities can, of course, and certainly do oppress minorities. And then there's a very basic point about people unable to realise their rights effectively if they don't have some very basic things about access to information and support. If you just look at what the results have been of cutting back on access to legal aid, you can just see one very obvious example of problems with democracy. But Lenin's formulation about the future disappearance of the state, I just find that so hypothetical that I can't get my head around it at all. I mean, Marx himself wasn't particularly concerned with trying to work out blueprints for utopias, though I think he did have quite a lot to say about the Paris Commune. And the idea, say, that you could have a socialist society, not a socialist state, without democracy is broadly defined. I think I've already indicated I'm not very keen on that. Swallow your leaders. Finally, six is, how's democracy related with the issue of achieving socialism? I think the implications of what I've been saying is that increasing democracy is an absolutely essential prerequisite for building movements for social transformation. But it's necessary, but absolutely by no means necessary as an ingredient in the wider struggle for socialism. So one of the implications of that is, I think, the need for political education to challenge far right, build informed support for progressive alternatives, and address people's feelings and frustrations, the kind of resentment that they have, very understandably in the present context, as well as providing more fully theoretically argued analytical alternatives. So I'll leave it there. And I think what I'm saying is fantastic that all this political discussion is going on. This seems to be an incredibly important ingredient of building movement.
James.
Patrick, thank you. And thank you, that was really interesting. The I suppose I would start with, I'm going to say a bit about where we are right now, but I want to say democracy, probably the most important thing and the highest achievement of human civilization ever. For the simple reason that I think, and I don't think it's different really from socialism. Socialism is and democracy are pretty much synonymous. I think in the sense that what socialism I understood in the 19th century socialist movements were to displace the anarchy of the market, the chaos of the social system that they were confronted with a deliberate and a conscious and which would suggest to me a disgust alternative, meaning that you take what's really spontaneity, the market, and put in its place a deliberative subjectivity, a collective subjectivity of the mass of people. About where we go and what we do, and we should think, more about why it's so fantastic. Because obviously you could disagree, but just the fact of having to explain to somebody else why you think this is a good route itself is like a massive step forward in your thinking, because it means that you then have to make what your ambitions are rational and reasonable, and to discover and elicit in other people what's worthwhile. And in the process, sometimes you work out that maybe you had a daft idea or an incomplete idea, and it's in the process of negotiating and talking with other people to build your movement. That, to me, that's the spirit of the democratic. I don't just mean in the absolute, what the government is or the, but in the movement, it's got to be democratic, because what you're doing is you're putting yourselves at the centre. It's like the core of like everything right about the Enlightenment, that instead of being subordinate to somebody else, you make yourselves the authors of your own destiny. And you can only really do that by cooperation, which means talking and negotiating and working out amongst each other, and sometimes arguing, sometimes disagreeing. And that's the core of democracy. Now, I can't avoid where we are, which is, I want to say first that whatever had happened in the referendum on June 2016, I thought it was a right decision to leave the European Union. Because the European Union is not a democracy, and in fact I'll defend this position I guess later. I think it's, generally speaking, it's worked, and it kind of made to suborn democracy, to frustrate democracy, and to undermine it, and to take decision making away from where people might have some opportunity of controlling it and put it somewhere else where they couldn't possibly put their hands upon it. So I think that decision was the right decision to take. I also then think that the fact that after what was a really very exciting and intriguing and more alive than I can remember at any time in the last 20 years, a living discussion about what was right, and that was a fabulous discussion. Loads of people have said to me since, people that didn't like the result, I have to say, nobody knew what was going on. And I think to them, were they asleep? But I knew what was going on, because I went to, it must have been about 20 separate meetings. I spoke at a few, but I was very happy to be in the audience listening to others, because in that process of that argument, it's a very, like, church hall, pub, bus, TV, Twitter, online, all kinds of layers of argument. People were trying to make themselves clear to other people about what they what motivated them, and in the doing of it, their arguments became crisp and electric and intriguing. Sometimes I hear people say, oh, that number on the side of the bus, I forget the number now, 350 million on the side of the bus, those poor deluded fools. And I'm thinking, you have no memory, because that was mercilessly crucified at the time. People made fun, they argued, and then they did sums, you know, they went and looked up what was the amount paid in and what was the amount paid back, and then they thought about, you know, could you, and it was the most disgusting I've ever seen. So to imagine that that was like, that it was a delusional moment, I think is so weird, because people were so alive at that point, thinking about all these different things. None of it very easily fitting into our traditional frameworks of a left-wing or a right-wing position. Some people seem very right-wing and right, and some people seem very left-wing and wrong, and vice versa. You know, that was it, and that was a new and interesting thing. Now, there's a couple of other kind of points that, you know, so I am a Leave. I love the Leave vote, and I think it's been great. And having said that, they've really, what was that fabulous phrase that that horrible right-wing man, Bolton or Brennan or somebody said, they've really walked this thing round the park. They've really walked this thing around. What he meant was that but it's, the depletion of whatever energy was in the referendum vote has been spectacular. And people often throw their hands up in the air and go, oh, look, isn't it terrible what's happening in Parliament? I said, yes, yes, it is. The Parliament has decided one thing, which is the opposite of the thing that was decided in the referendum. And they can't quite bring themselves to do what they obviously all want to do, is nine-tenths of them anyway, is to revoke Article 50 and to junk the decision. And they don't dare do it because, what authority does the Parliament have? The authority derives from the people. And so if you tear up the people's decision and throw it away, then you have nothing. I don't think this is a trivial point. Why do people obey the law? You know, why don't we hit each other over the head and rob each other? You know, why are we peaceable and law-abiding people? Because we respect the laws that are passed, if only distantly in our name, but because we feel that somehow we own the institution that made those laws. Now, imagine if that institution turns around to us and say, you're rubbish, you don't count, your voice is null, we'll do what we like. That's really saying, and so the next person in court is going to say, oh, you know, well, that's what Parliament does. If they don't say it out loud, they'll say it in their heads. Well, you know, so it's a real disaster just for everybody, I think. I've gone on a bit. I'm very much for that, and that's what I see happening now, is this decision being thrown away, and it is an attack on democracy. Now, having said that, I think if there were a second referendum, I don't think it's likely, it's quite possible that it would have gone the other way, because it was a relatively closely fought thing. I'd say bring it on. You know, I think it's a cheat to make people have a second referendum, but I'd rather fight the second referendum and, you know, win all over again, because it's about, you know, the value of the voice, about the value of the decision making. To go back to the points, why is it that democracy is, you know, has been so alive? And I think it is alive in the Gilets Jaunes protests. It's different. But having been amongst it, it's really intriguing just how much the protests are very, very intriguing, mad kind of a protest, really thrilling. But the way they mobilise the rhetoric of the distant Macron and the people, and the use of the French flag, which I think is really intriguing. I read to be not nationalistic in a mean-spirited way, but an attempt to situate themselves in the popular, which I think is right and good and exciting. I guess my short point would be that the reason people these clashes have come up in the realm of democracies, because that's what people most pointedly feel is lacking, is that they're being driven out of mainstream politics. They've been reduced to voting fodder. They're not connected. You know, they've been chased out of the Labour Party. Even the Conservative Party grassroots have fed up with being treated like they're just people to put distant characters into power. And that sense of, you know, what's missing in our lives, very eloquently summed up in Dominic Cummings' election slogan, to take back control. It could argue with the tense there, you know, were we in control? But I think it speaks to people because it speaks most clearly to what we don't have, control. You know, and that's why I think democracy is absolutely alive. It's because it's what's missing in our lives is control. Yes, you've got control in your flat. You know, you can sweep up or not. But you know, once you step out, suddenly we're hit with a world which is very quickly is out of our control. And even in the flat, of course, it turns out that, you know, not being in control out there makes your own personal circumstances enslaved in it. I don't want to say enslaved, it's too grand, but, you know, not free.
2 minutes.
I think I've done it.
Okay, great. Adam?
Yep.
The best next.
Yep. I think we need to start by defining terms, or in particular the term democracy. I think it's got two basic meanings. One is it's an organisational form, which can be any club or association can take. And the second meaning is political democracy, which is in fact a form of the capitalist state. Well, to begin with political democracy, I say this is a form of the capitalist state where those who run the administration at national, local levels, they're elected by the population on a regular basis in more or less free and fair elections. But it's still a limited form of democracy as an organisational form, as it only applies to public administration, and then only imperfectly. I mean, it doesn't apply to control, ownership and control of the means of production, and so not to what is produced and for who it is produced. I mean, these means of production, they're in the hands of rich individuals, capitalist corporations, or unelected state bureaucrats, which in fact, of course, undermines democracy, because it means that those with money have got more influence on what happens than the electorate. So, as they say, some are more equal than others in a capitalist political democracy. Now, all the same, despite its limitations, there's always been the Marxian socialist position, going back to Marx himself, that political democracy is the best political form under capitalism within which the working class movement, both industrial and political, can develop. And I agree with the definition that's been given of working class already. It's 95% of the population, anybody that is forced by economic necessity to go out and sell their labour power on the market to some employer. Now, what I'm talking about here is so-called political rights, such as freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of organisation, universal suffrage, and the like. I would say that at a certain stage, socialists should contest elections, and they should take their seats in Parliament, unlike Sinn Féin, which could make a difference to various votes in the House of Commons. They should take their seats in Parliament and on local councils. And in fact, if there is a stable political democracy, then the possibility exists, as was recognised in fact by Marx, of winning control of political power in order to abolish capitalism by declaring that the means of production are the common property of the whole of society under democratic control and administration, in other words, socialism. Now, to deal with some of the questions, not necessarily in order, by the way. You know, the second one is about have historical struggles for democracy by workers been the medium by which they get assimilated to the system, or were they the only path to emancipation that they couldn't avoid trying to take? Well, I'd say both. I mean, the working class had to struggle for political democracy in its own immediate and future interest, but the coming of the political democracy has led to them becoming, well, I wouldn't actually use the word assimilated, perhaps it's more appropriate would be something like less discontented with capitalism. I mean, it's provided a means, a safety valve, by which some of their grievances have been dealt with. And historically, it's led to the working class supporting reformism and possibilism in the form of Labour and Social Democratic parties, or for that matter, incidentally, of the defunct communist parties. But this is not a reason to, this is not a reason to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Mm. Now, skipping to the questions 4 and 5 about what Engels and Lenin had to say about political democracy. I think that when Engels wrote that the revolution is the most authoritarian thing there is, he didn't mean that it should be carried out by a party organised on authoritarian lines, which is what Lenin advocated, at least for Tsarist Russia. What he meant was that any revolution involves one class imposing its will on another. It's one class forcing another class to give up its power and privileges. Now, the anarchists who he was polemicizing with, you know, they were in favor of this, but they said we're against all authority, which was a contradiction, which enabled Engels to score a debating point. Whether it's a cheap debating point or not, I don't know, but it enabled Engels to score a debating point. Now, Engels' description of a revolution as authoritarian would apply even if the revolution was carried out through political democracy by the working class itself organised democratically, because it would still be a question of one class imposing its will on another. The working class would be imposing its will on the capitalist class by dispossessing them. So I don't think that is what Engels said is incompatible with political democracy. Now, as to Lenin, I mean, he was repeating something that the young Engels had said in 1843, but because democracy was in the sense of a form of state, and because the state, we'll argue about this afterwards, would disappear in communism, which Engels later called socialism, therefore so would democracy. If democracy is a form of state and socialism and communism is a stateless society, then obviously socialism and communism isn't a democracy in that sense. But I don't think this means that there wouldn't be any election of mandated, irrevocable delegates in socialism. But I'm not sure about Lenin. I'm not a fan of Lenin. He might have believed that was the case in socialism, but if any Leninists can defend him. Now, to return to the other question, this question 2, about democracy as an organisational reform. Now, this, as I said before, this can be applied to any club or any association, just as much as it could do to a trade union or a political party. And here I would say, yes, this should be the ideal form of a trade union, and has to be, as a matter of principle, that of a socialist party or group. Now, this question 2 talks about the current mass form of politics. Well, insofar as there is any mass participation in politics today, it takes the form of passively voting for political parties led by professional politicians, which promise to do things for those who voted for them, which if you vote for them, you've no control over these politicians or parties. Now, all the people can do is likely crowd in the Roman Colosseum. You can either sort of thumbs up or thumbs down every so many years. In between, people get on with their lives, and occasionally watching the passing show and taking part in debates about Brexit or question time and things like that. So that's most of the conventional politics is for them. Now, it's true that occasionally mass intervention in politics takes a different form, more or less spontaneous street demonstrations, so-called people's power. I mean, the most recent example in Europe has been the Yellow Vests in France. And before that, there were similar movements in Greece. I think there were some also in Slovakia and Armenia, but I don't know much about those. Now, this is certainly a different form of mass politics to voting for conventional parties led by professional politicians. And it's also contrary to the Leninist idea of mass politics as a mass of discontented people being led by a disciplined party of professional revolutionaries. However, I'm not convinced that it can be said, the point's already been made, that democracy was the aim of these movements. It's been much more specific about austerity or getting rid of some unpopular government. But what has characterised them, and this is where great minds think alike, incidentally, has been their lack of organisation, their structure, and their structurelessness. I mean, this is not the same as democracy. It can be undemocratic, as was mentioned, explained, in fact, in that famous 1971 pamphlet by Joe Freeman, The Tyranny of Structurelessness, which is based on the experience of the women's liberation movement in the 1960s. Now, she pointed out, and I'm quoting her, how this apparent lack of structure too often disguised an informal, unacknowledged, and unaccountable leadership that was all the more pernicious because its very existence was denied. Basically, what it means is the leadership were those with the biggest or the loudest mouths. I mean, this seems to me to be an accurate description of the Yellow Vests. In other words, they're not really an example of a democratic mass movement. I mean, a genuinely democratic mass movement, it's essential. It's not just desirable, but it's necessary if capitalism is to be replaced by socialism as a society based on the common ownership and democratic control of productive resources, with production and distribution directly to satisfy people's needs. How much longer have I got? 2 minutes. Well, that's been enough on the last page. So what would a democratic mass movement look like? And we're looking for something different, both from existing conventional politics and from structureless movements like the Yellow Vests. Now, one model would be the constitution, though sadly not the practice, of some trade unions, a local branch organized democratically, which sends delegates to conference, which elects a committee executive to carry out this policy. But because it's not just a question of formal structures, it's a question of people must have the democratic consciousness to participate and make use of these structures. As to the final question, number six, how is democracy related to the issue of achieving socialism? Well, I don't suppose it won't surprise you, but we already guess what is the position, my position, and that of the Socialist Party. I mean, socialism, as has already been mentioned, it's the highest form of democracy. It's the principle of democratic organisation applied to society as a whole. In fact, one of the names that socialism used to be known as was social democracy. I mean, what this means in practical terms is that every member of society stands in the same position in regard to the use of the means of production. I mean, there's no group that has an exclusive or preferential say in how they're used. In short, there's no longer any ruling class. If there's no exclusive there is an exclusive group, controlling group, then there isn't any socialism. I mean, socialism without democracy, as has just been pointed out, it's a contradiction in concerns. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
All right. So there are, I think, three different strategies for advancing left-wing politics. The first is the traditional revolutionary approach, in which the left organizes in preparation for an acute legitimacy crisis or objective revolutionary situation. The second is the traditional reformist approach, in which the left attempts to construct members-based labor parties which compete in elections with the human and financial resources of worker civil society organizations like unions. The third is the new party capture approach, in which the left uses calls for democracy to institutionally hollow out already dominant bourgeois parties and gut the party elites from within. With some reservations, I will argue for the party capture approach and against the other two approaches. There are lots of little problems with the traditional revolutionary approach. It was one thing to call for revolutionary politics when the ordinary citizen was armed with the same musket or rifle the soldiers carried. Now there's a big gap in hardware between the citizen and the state. It was one thing to argue that the military might defect to the left when the military was made up of draftees and conscripts. Now it is made up of professionals and skews heavily right-wing. It was one thing to argue for revolutionary politics when revolutionary states like the Soviet Union had some credibility as competitive, meaningful alternatives. Now these states are widely recognized by ordinary people to have been not only uncompetitive, but also morally repugnant. It is irrelevant to what extent one thinks the prevailing view about the Soviet Union is true. That's how most ordinary workers in Western states feel about it. There are similar small problems for the traditional reformist approach. Unions are declining in both membership and resources, and they are less capable of supporting these parties than in the past. To remain competitive, many of the post-war members-based parties have engaged in neoliberal triangulation and are not meaningfully left-wing anymore. The fact that they were members-based did not protect them from right-wing capture. But there is a larger problem for both of these traditional approaches. They no longer track the concept of democracy in the way it is generally understood by 21st century people. Over the lifespan of democracy, democratic legitimation mechanics have constantly evolved and changed. There was a time when it was possible to call yourself a democracy despite property and gender restrictions on voting. That time has passed, and the kind of political system which prevailed in the 19th century no longer strikes people as meaningfully democratic. The same is true of the 20th century approaches. They are now out of sync with what the term democracy means to our people. In the past, movements for democracy often emphasized franchise expansion. But today, advocates of democratization are increasingly looking to democratize the political parties themselves. This means taking the power to select candidates away from committees and smoke-filled rooms. Instead, they want candidates to be selected by ordinary people in a transparent, accountable fashion. The parties, to retain democratic legitimacy, have been slowly accommodating this movement. It has been carried furthest in the United States, where binding primaries now select candidates not just for president, but for most down-ballot races. In the states, you don't have to be a party member or a registered supporter to vote in primaries, and many millions of people participate in them. Party and media elites attempt to curate the primaries with endorsements, dark money from oligarchs, and politically motivated news content. But they were unable to prevent Bernie Sanders from running a highly competitive race, and they were unable to stop Donald Trump from winning outright. In the UK, Corbyn became leader principally because of decisions Ed Miliband made to legitimate the party to internal pro-democracy movements. This has created an alignment problem in which the leader is out of sync with most of the MPs. Thus far, it has been impossible to remove the leader because of his support from ordinary Labour supporters, and this makes it likely that there will eventually need to be an institutional change in the way MPs are selected, moving the party further in the American direction. Miliband's institutional schema is insufficiently stable and will likely give way to further pushes for democratization within Labour. In my view, these institutional changes create some new possibilities for the left. There are three key reasons for this. The first is that the neoliberal consensus is struggling to restore legitimacy post-2008. But rather than lead to calls for revolution or the formation of new competitive members-based parties, this has instead largely led to party capture movements. Secondly, the ability of media moguls to gatekeep the discourse has been diminished by the rise of the internet and social media. This has only recently become a factor. It is now cheaper and easier than ever before to get competitive left-wing messages out without catering to these tastemakers. This change is furthest advanced in America, where the market for independent media is largest. But it is still in development. We are going to go further in this direction, especially as demographics shift and younger, more online voters displace older voters with more traditional media palettes. Third, the more party elites attempt to intervene openly in candidate selection, the more this conflicts with these new democratic legitimation mechanics, increasing pressure on elites to make further concessions for fear of demobilizing base voters or pushing them to defect to fringe third party and independent candidates. Serious interventions by elites in party politics thus have serious long-term costs. They cannot intervene now without diminishing their ability to intervene later. In this respect, the party elites increasingly find themselves in the position of the feudal aristocracy in the 19th century. The more power they attempt to deploy, the weaker they become. For these reasons, I think the party capture approach presents the left with a real possibility of winning power in some of the richest and most powerful democratic nation states. Consequently, I do not think representative democracy is itself the primary obstacle to left-wing success. The larger impediment is globalization. As states become more economically integrated and trade volumes skyrocket, states become enmeshed in races to the bottom on taxes, regulations, and wages in bids to prevent jobs, investment, and their own citizens from migrating to foreign states. Attempts to undo this economic integration by returning to capital controls, harder borders, and protectionism result in severe economic shocks because the level of integration is now quite high. Left-wing governments who do these things have little hope of winning re-election, and therefore initially promising electoral victories can turn to ashes in their mouths. This is especially true in the European context, where EU institutions have created considerable economic integration without the accompanying political integration required to manage it. Without strong regional political institutions, decision-making defaults to the powerful states, and that means Germany can inflict austerity and labor market reforms on other states without limit. So in Europe, left-wing politics requires not merely the election of left-wing governments at the national level, but substantial revision of European institutions so that economic integration can be politically managed. This means a left turn in Europe requires a whole international coalition of left-wing governments, all of whom are in office at the same time with roughly the same conception of the problem and heavily overlapping notions of the institutional solution. This is much more challenging to achieve. Prospects may be better in the United States because it is already a large, powerful, united political bloc. The difficulty in America is the sheer number of offices that must be won to accomplish anything. The American left must not only take the Democratic Party away from the establishment which still dominates it, it must then defeat the Republican Party in hundreds of congressional races and compete for senators, state legislators, and governorships in deep red states. This requires a considerable amount of social movement building beyond the mere election of someone like Bernie Sanders to the presidency. So when we look at democracy today, the question is not whether the left can win. I am increasingly confident that we can compete. The question is whether the left can win enough stuff at one time to overcome the internal institutional barriers it faces in the USA and the external institutional barriers it faces in Europe. While left-wing forces are increasingly electorally competitive through means of party capture, they still have a long way to go in finding replacement political organizations for the declining unions and in fully utilizing the power of independent and online media. Given the low material barriers to entry, it remains shocking how uncompetitive the left is on platforms like YouTube, and organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America are not sufficiently engaged in the electoral process. Unfortunately, it is all too common for people on the left to respond to these challenges by retreating into alternative approaches which have no real prospect of going anywhere. Revolutions and new members-based third parties have no traction in the 21st century. In the United States, members-based parties are even illegal in many states because the American conception of party democracy is now completely oriented around primaries with wide electorates. Far too many people are hiding from the reality that the approaches that might have found success a century ago are now exhausted. As difficult and as challenging as it may be, party capture is now the principal path open to the left, and it must rise to the occasion and make a go of it. If it does not, this contemporary crisis may instead lead to a turn even further right as a post-Brexit UK considers a free trade agreement with Donald Trump's America.
Okay, so let's start now with brief sort of questions that you might have for each other. So, say 3 minutes, Marge, do you have any?
I'd rather hear what, I mean, I've really enjoyed hearing what everybody has to say so far. I'd rather, I'll wait my 3 minutes to hear from the audience and maybe come back later if I may.
James, do you have any points you'd like to raise with?
I'm sympathetic and enjoyed some intriguing points, but I honestly think that the there's a kind of reverse approach here, that we imagine that there's a set of nostrums and ideas that we inherit from the past that we call left wing, you know, about means of production and classes and the left, which I think are mostly kind of empty, formal, just phrases, really, without a real meaning. I don't know what left... most people I meet on the left, I really hate lots of things they say. You know, maybe I'm just right wing, but you know, the willingness to run to the teacher to ask for, you know, discipline of you know, some bad statement. And I think, are these the people I like? I'm not always sure. So I don't think I can believe in a left that has, you know, had some clear idea of itself. And I feel the same a little bit, Marjorie and Adam, a little bit that the language of means of production and classes is kind of 19th century and really needs to be, I don't mean to rework just for the sake of it, I mean to say we need to elicit in the present, in the same way that Marx and Engels did. They didn't, you know, present categories in front of people and say, you know, obey this. They drew those categories out of the arguments that people were having. All of the basic Marx categories are, you know, terminology from the arguments within the Chartist movement of the 1840s, labour power and wage slavery. These were actually commonplace phrases amongst the Chartists, but they're not commonplace phrases in 2019. They are amongst a certain group of people who I fear, you know, and I'm guilty of this myself, relegate themselves to the outside of, you know, some like live action replay, sealed knot society. And I would rather, we shouldn't make a program and put it in front of people. We need to make a program through the debate with other people. And we need to be remaking an ideology or a poetry for our age out of these struggles that people are in.
Thank you.
I will come back on that, but I'll wait.
Sorry, I won't. Cheat of order.
Please.
Adam?
Yeah, we've got to discuss Brexit, I think. It's become... People in Britain now don't discuss the weather. They discuss Brexit. But... I mean, basically, it's all about trade. If you watched the debate in Parliament last night, they were voting on, what was it, six or seven things. What were they? European Free Trade Agreement, Single Market, Customs Union. What Brexit is about is a dispute within the, sorry about this, ruling class, the capitalist class in Britain, as to what as to what their trading policy will be. The referendum wasn't about democracy and that. It was about what should be the trading arrangements of Britain, PLC. And that's what the members of the Parliament cannot agree on what they should... what this should be. They're representing different sections who've got different interests. But I agree with you that the Parliament can't simply, from a democratic point of view, revoke Article 50. The result of the referendum can only be reversed by another referendum. That's how we operate in our party. We have a party poll. If it goes one way, there's nothing stopping people having another one to reverse it. That's perfectly perfectly democratic. But I mean, if there is another referendum, I'm afraid of two things. The last campaign was pretty bad as far as the Leavers were concerned with xenophobia. I think if there's another referendum, they're going to pull out the stops, and it's going to be even worse next time than it was you know, last time. It'll be, you know, kick out the Poles, kick out the Pakis. That's what it's going to be, you know, again. But so if there's a referendum and the choice is going to be, what do I think the trading arrangements of the British capitalist class should be? Should it be in the common market, a single union, or customs union, and all this? Or should it be a border down the middle of Ireland, or in the North Sea or the Irish Sea or whatever? No, I agree with Nigel Farage here. If that's the choice, I'm going to go fishing. I'm not going to have to get holy. I'm not going to vote. I might go and vote. I'll go right across my ballot paper. Bollocks a lot of you. I want socialism. So why are we getting involved in this in this argument, which doesn't concern us? It's purely concerns British capitalist class. So that's my...
Plainly not, given that 34 million people voted.
Yeah, but they were on both sides. They were
deluded imbeciles. Is that your point?
Not quite. Deluded is all right.
Well, but then you don't believe in democracy, do you? You basically it makes perfect sense if you believe that people are too foolish to govern their lives.
I didn't say that. I said that people had been drawn into a dispute which wasn't their concern. They were there on both sides. People.
Well, how foolish of them!
I stop you both there. For the moment.
I don't disagree with that. How foolish are I agree.
Anyway, Benjamin, did you have anything you wanted to...
Oh, I will happily follow Marjorie in yielding my time to the people.
Excellent. Okay, so...
did Marjorie want to come in on something Dave said?
Well, at some point, I certainly want to...
Well, you can come in
then. I'll just say one thing, that if people are taking Marx and Lenin or Engels or whoever else, as you pick a quote and then apply it, that is absolute nonsense to me, and I have no interest in doing that whatsoever. To me, Marx provides a set of tools which you then use or not and apply to different situations. And obviously you don't use language about means of production when you're talking to people on the street corner.
I do.
Because it's not going... Well, you might do, but you use the language that is going to engage your audience. Actually, just one final point on referendums. I mean, I'm not particularly keen on another referendum. I have serious doubts about how it would be held. But I do think I've been a member of UCU, and I voted when we went on strike, you know. And I voted when there was a deal as to whether I wanted to go back to work or not. That seems to me to be entirely democratic, anyway.
Okay. So if you raise your hands nice and high so I can see you. Yes.
Yeah. So the panel have unanimously said that socialism and democracy are one and the same, can be one and the same.
No.
Okay. Well, maybe they should be one and the same. So I was going to ask why, when so many when you do get socialists in power, so often they abandon their democratic ideal. I mean, historically, either to communism, which has abandoned political democracy, or social democracy, which has totally abandoned industrial democracy. And how can we stop that happening in the future?
If you'd like to respond.
I can take that. Because for the most part, left-wing theorists don't do state institutions very well, don't think about them very well. The no blueprints thing often prevents people from doing institutional proposals in any kind of sophisticated way. And there's a tendency to think in a very reductive way about the state, that whichever class controls the state will straightforwardly reflect that class's interests. And therefore, there's no real need to think any further about how state institutions are organized. Once socialism happens, however it happens, the state institutions will just by magic fall out the way they're supposed to fall out. This is, I think, the biggest weakness in left-wing political theory, and something which badly needs rectification immediately.
Anyone else? Well, I would say that socialism never has happened. There have been revolutions where a minority of people have seized power and called it socialist, but it hasn't been socialism. And the real antidote to a minority, a change of rulers, a new ruling class coming about, is, to come back to what we were just talking about, it's the consciousness of people. People have got to have a socialist consciousness. People have got to have a democratic consciousness. And if they haven't got that, and they didn't, I mean, you mentioned Russia, there wasn't really a tiny minority of, you know, socialists there, and socialism cannot be imposed on one people who don't want it. It's I mean that would, you know, be the answer I would give.
James, or
well, I would say that the things that jump out are your defensiveness. I think 9 times out of 10, whenever you're, you know, I remember this like with the local authorities and all the rest. People were on the defensive, and I kind of shrink a bit when I hear people say, oh, you know, the capitalists will seek to do this and, you know, we'll be cheated that way, because it usually is like kind of preparatory to, therefore we don't need to wash our clothes in public, and, you know, we ought to be, you know, discipline the message, and it usually means like shut up and don't think about what you're doing is the other thing. Along with the defensiveness, I think it's a kind of opportunistic, you know, we've got the levers of power now, we'll never give them up, you know, because they'll trick us, and everybody forgets, and this is why I think the democracy point is right, is that no socialist movement in any, I mean, granted, you know, there's, you know, they're obviously wrong because they're wrong, but you know, whenever socialists have authority, they forget that they're only there by virtue of the people that put them there, and it's much better to risk losing in the struggle to win opinion, you know, in the struggle to make your points intelligible to other people, than it is to hang on to what is really is a chimera of power. You know, it's not the real power. The real power comes from the mass of people, and you have to re-engage it and all the rest.
I think, I mean, it is a key question. I think you're absolutely right to raise it. And of course, there are all sorts of reasons why there was civil war in Soviet Union and so on. All these things are factors, but they don't. That's not a sufficient answer. I sometimes think, just go back to my personal experiences in political parties, and you see it all around you. Some people have got loud voices, and other people become intimidated, and that has to be challenged. It really has to be challenged. Never mind gender. I mean, about how women find it even harder often to actually be heard in those circumstances.
Let's see. Okay, you please.
Hi, thank you. I suppose my question is, why do you take elections and referendums to be so emblematic of democracy?
I think that might be a me.
Yeah, to be honest.
Sorry, I've said a lot. And, you know, I wouldn't fixate on any form. You know, it's...
why not something like sortition?
I can't even remember what that is, so you'd have to explain. But
if you take democracy back to its like roots in ancient Athens, it's a lottery that chooses a random selection of people to study an issue and then come to a common good through it.
I guess because we're not in ancient Athens, but
that model.
It's a model.
Because I found something that you said quite problematic. You said, democracy is the highest form of civilization, and so I'm wondering then, to what extent does democracy become a kind of, I don't know, tool of Western colonialism, if you think about it through elections, if you think about it through certain democratic states, and to qualify as a modern state you have to have an election. So for example, what happened in South Sudan, for it to be recognized as a modern state, it had to hold elections and it had to abide to this certain model of the nation state, whereas previously there were democratic ways of coming to decisions and working through things that weren't based on this idea of elections and referendums that fit the modern nation state. And so that's my question to you.
Okay, well, this is my answer, is that I don't think the form is the important question. An election could be, you know, like the election in 1935 in Germany was obviously not a democratic election. The opposition parties had been imprisoned. It was the form of the thing, it was the husk. It was a performance of an election, not a real election. So, you can have any kind of form that with a real content or a not, you know. So and a referendum, like in a Nazi plebiscite, I think is, you know, it's with the threat of violence and all the rest, it's just, that's not a thing. You can only way you can say, you know, is this right or is this wrong? I know I don't have any fetish for any particular form, you know, referendum, I don't care. Referendum, yes. Referendum, no. Elections, yes. Elections, no. But the spirit of the thing, the essence is this, is that, as George Lukács made the point, he said it's about societal self-determination. It's do we give ourselves the law? Is it self-determination? Is it a free subjectivity of a people? And that must mean, I think, to be, and this isn't like to pass judgment on the past or in other countries or whatever. All I'm saying is that what will be robust and effective will be that political condition under which you must seek the greatest consensus to your point of view, because if you channel it and you you know, there's people have lots of dodges, like citizens assemblies or youth assemblies and youth parliaments, and they're largely about dissipating and avoiding the centralisation. And I think democracy really does mean centralisation. There must be a centralisation of power for it to be contestable. Dissipated power, and I think that's the point that Joe Freeman was making, is in its nature tyrannical, because only domineering elites succeed when power is dissipated or disguised or hidden behind apparently open structures. So yeah, I think I'm pretty pointedly disagreeing with you.
I think form is important. I'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Adam, so you're taking this.
I mean, direct democracy is only possible in small groups. So there has to be, how do you choose people? How do you choose, if you like, delegates to, you know, what you suggest, choosing by lot is one, and other.
I'm not suggesting that.
No, okay. What has been suggested, choosing people by lot is one. You can election is another, but you have elections for short periods of time. You can place limitations on how long somebody can be a delegate. You know, in the British Parliament, there's 11 MPs that have changed political parties, and normally you would expect them to give up their seats and contest an election. But in fact, here America is more democratic than Britain. If they'd been members of the United States House of Representatives, they couldn't have hung on for another 3 years. They'd be up for re-election within 2 years. And you know, America has another thing, which, well, there is a recall going on now. You can recall people as delegates if you don't agree with what they're doing. So the thing is to make the people that you know, being that direct democracy can't, you know, you can't have 60 million people deciding things directly. You have to have your delegates. So the various ways we making these delegates responsible to the people that have elected them. In fact, this would be one reason why, on a theoretical ground, I don't think a referendum is necessarily the best way of doing it, because this is what this capitalist class mess has got itself into. It's a yes no, and you know, what does no mean? Because there's so many different interpretations of no. So it's probably best at some point to have a committee of delegates, which, because the answer generally isn't yes or no, it's something in between, or it's so you know, I'm not a fan of referendums myself.
Okay. I'll just answer very briefly that I am sympathetic to your critique, because democracy is frequently used to as a normative excuse for all kinds of institutional arrangements which are barbaric and garbage. And the word democracy is frequently deployed by people who want to impose a certain kind of decision on other people to force them to recognize that decision's legitimacy. And so that's why democracy has in some places meant Athens, and in other places it's meant Britain in 1870, where women can't vote and there are property requirements for voting. So we should always be extremely skeptical whenever anyone tries to assert normatively, moralistically, that something is democratic and something else isn't, because very frequently this is just a mask for whatever it is that they want to do anyway.
Well, I'm certainly agree that democratic forms can be imposed as part of neocolonial projects, no question. I think I was trying to say that there are different forms of democracy that work in different contexts. You know, I think citizens' juries, for instance, can work very well in some contexts and do. I can't imagine how the whole Brexit thing could have been handled in that way. I think that's another question. But it's of course democracy is about choosing who takes decisions publicly, but it's also about the whole range of democratic rights. It's about control of the workplace, however much you can have in a capitalist society. But it is also about other rights, which I think are extremely important. Freedom of speech, the whole range of access to the law, which we have in a very limited way at the moment. But I think that's a very basic one, too.
It's you, sir.
four erudite people in front of me, very interesting. Just to sort of state my case, I'm a working class bloke. I went to Ruskin, but I didn't complete the course. Ooh. I was doing English. What concerns me here is the use of language. Mm-hmm. I'm working class bloke. When I speak to my friends around the pub, if I come out with ideas like legitimation mechanics, they're about as chance of understanding that as quantum mechanics. You know, you clever people, you've got to find a way of getting through to working class people, and some of the language you use pushes them away. Yeah. So, the tyranny of structurelessness, what does that mean? I haven't got a clue what that means, and I've got to try to do postmodern language, and that's bad enough. So, I think if you're going to get more, so where are any working class MPs? Working class people have been shut out of the whole process, and the language you use, you're talking heads, doesn't encourage them to get into the process.
Nice to you.
I think it's a very fair point. To be honest, I assume that the people here mostly were Goldsmith students, so I was using language that I thought was, you know. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't go in the pub and talk about
it. Well, that's the area that I mix in. They're the people I mix in, and that's why if there was a language that they could access, and people spoke to them in a way they could access it, and they're not stupid people, then they would actually become more democratic in their approach.
Well, I worked at Ruskin, and they're perfectly well. Of course, people aren't stupid if they use different language because they've had different experiences.
Yeah, I would speak completely differently if I were running a campaign or in a pub. I'm talking this way because I presume I'm talking to university students and people with university educations. I would not speak this way to any kind of mass audience. And I think that your critique is very right, and it's part of why we have no influence on YouTube and a lot of platforms which cater to popular groups.
The tyranny of structurelessness. It's the title, but the idea is surely easy to understand. It's where people have got the most the loudest mouth develop things. And in fact, in that pamphlet, which I recommend people to read, Joe Freeman suggests various ways of coming around this. I mean, I can list them here, and it's not complicated language. Delegation of a specific authority to specific individuals for specific tasks by democratic procedures, requiring all those to whom authority has been delegated to be responsible for those who selected them. Distribution of authority among as many people as is reasonably possible. Rotation of tasks amongst individuals. Diffusion of information to everyone. I mean, these are a simple contrast. No doubt in your local football club, this is the principles that you act on.
I think my point is that, working class people are unrepresented. And they're unrepresented because the language that is given to them for them to understand is not language that they deal with in their daily lives. And, you know, this other business, which irritates me tremendously, it was kind of like, well, it was like, or it was kind of like. Say what it is. What's the point of saying it was kind of like, or kind of like, wow? Well, I mean, what is all that about?
They don't do that in universities.
Well, you don't do that. You don't do that, John Ruskin, no, of course.
James?
But I'm a half sympathetic and a half irritated, because you're kind of saying, oh, shut up.
Kind of, so
yeah.
You're doing it again.
Well, I am saying doing it. But it's like you're arguing with like you're arguing with my daughters, like loads of working class people who happen to be young, you know. So you want to say we should obey the rules of rhetoric that obtain in your pub.
No, I'm
as opposed to the rules of rhetoric that happen in my daughter's school. So, well, let's use both.
Well, I just think the English language is a great language to use, and I think it can be used better by everyone.
Right? For sure.
And this kind of like business is Americanization of this language, of our language.
Americans speak English.
No, they sort of put in some friends and all that. Oh, it was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, wow. I mean, hey, Joe.
All right.
I mean, the back there, did I see?
Yeah. So Ben, particularly, sorry, this is like really hyper interest because I'm starting to research this. But your discussion about YouTube and saying that there's no response from the left, why do you think about that? And do you know about like channels like ContraPoints, VelocityTube, H Bomber Guy, and why would you say, okay, I assume so, and why would you say there aren't an appropriate response to the left? Because I personally think that they're quite accessible. They use lay language and they use a medium that is, like, in terms of editing, in terms of content, that is very relatable and has, to an extent, brought people over, at least from the far right, either to the center or radicalized them to the left. So why would you say that's not on a good enough response?
It's some kind of response, and we're much better off having those channels than not having them. But in terms of the numbers of subscribers and the number of hits on those channels in comparison with the alt-right channels, we're not anywhere remotely close right now. There's a big imbalance on YouTube and on several other, Reddit in particular, I think skews quite right-wing. And these are platforms where we have some presence, and I like a number of those channels, but I think we need a lot more presence. And part of the problem is, as this gentleman has mentioned, there's a reluctance on the part of left-wing academics and elite people to talk in that kind of language. So, for instance, we all want to have podcasts because we can be all fancy on podcasts, and the elite educated audience loves to listen to podcasts in the car on the way to work, right? But this kind of stuff doesn't reach very large audiences. And we have to be willing to, as much as we may find it uncomfortable and difficult, find a way to talk to people in much the way that the gentleman has mentioned.
So is it much more like a numbers game that we have to play? It's just like the volume of channels is much more...
The volume, and then also we need to have channels that have just much bigger reach. ContraPoints is good, but it's just not big enough. We need bigger.
Anyone else have any points they want to add? No? Yes, the gentleman here.
Well, thank you very much to all the speakers. I've got a couple of different questions, but I think I'll just go with one, which is that the issue of Chartism has been brought up, and the issue of the difference between democracy, let's say in the American Revolution, and democracy in the 1840s, which appears to be a kind of crisis of democracy rather than its full flowering in some way. And for Marx, this was really important in thinking about, you know, he didn't just take up the language from the Chartists, although he did. He also was trying to point out how it was limited in some way. And James, I know you bring up this point about the poetry of the past and the poetry of the future. But one of the points there was that the demand for democracy was a symptom of a attempting to complete the French Revolution in some way in Britain, or to complete the English Revolution, that people were taking up the language of, in the Chartist movement, of the American Revolution and the Jacobins, and that there was somehow a new problem on the scene. Marx was pointing to some kind of contradiction in the radical democratic language that they were bringing up. And his example of this was in 1848 in France, and then in 1852, where Louis Bonaparte was elected by the first male universal suffrage elections, and that it turned out to be not the achievement of socialism, but a form of authoritarianism, a new form of the state. So my question is, to what extent is democracy actually an expression of a crisis of society and a way of managing society, rather than the achievement of the possibilities of society?
I don't think it's true that the Chartists were seeking to realise either the French or the American revolutions. They were, having read quite a lot of The Northern Star and the rest, one of the great things about it is that it's jam-packed with a mad debate about political economy, about plutocracy. It's much more Marxist than Marx, really, because they're obsessed with wage slavery and all those arguments. But the reason that it came together, and I think Gareth Stephen-Jones is very, very wrong on this, I think the reason it came together as a democratic demand is because of the condition, which wasn't from 1776 or from 1789, it was from 1832, because all of not just the working class but the middle class have been involved in this intense contest to democratize their society, to take control from a corrupt oligarchy, the thing it was called, and then there'd been this awful deal, you know, where Finality Jack, John Russell, had said, well, I've got an idea, let's give the vote to middle class people and not the working class people. And you couldn't walk into any town in West Yorkshire or Newcastle or anywhere and say anything but we've got to have the vote, because this was the issue that was right in front of people, and it was like it was the moment where their brutalization was made most obvious, because the one thing that said you are not fully human, you're not citizens, you're not in this thing, is that you don't have the vote. And so when they came to write, occasionally they'd talk about Robespierre or whatever, not very much. Mostly they talked about 1832, because it was like a dagger in their heart. You know, what they'd been told was in the lead up to the Reform Bill debate was that we're going to fight for democracy, and then they were told, no, we didn't mean it, we just meant for these people here and not for you. And in the same way that women in the 1890s started to agitate around the 1880s about the women's vote, after having been very active in the social purity movement, different things, as a woman you couldn't have been, it was the one issue that you couldn't sleep because of this fact that you've been denied the vote. So there was loads of other infrastructure of oppression, of the domestic condition and of property rights and all the rest of it. But what was the emblematic moment that told you you were a second-class citizen was you didn't have the vote. Same with the Civil Rights Movement or the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. What clearer message could there be that you do not count than that your democratic decision is torn up in front of your face? It's no main surprise to me that when the referendum happened in 2016, by and large, working class people voted leave, and by and large, middle class people voted remain. It's plain as the nose on your face, because the people who felt robbed and cheated and angry and disabused were the ones who tended to vote leave, because they were registering their complaint against the political system. And the ones who wanted to keep it all as it was and don't rock the boat and don't question stuff were the ones who would, as a rule, would vote remain. Sorry, I went into leave and remain again there.
Nigel?
I just say that I do think that crisis of democratic legitimacy, sorry to use that word again, are you could see them in terms of other forms of crisis, that the existing forms to manage conflicts in society are unable to manage. Just one final point, yes. On people who voted leave. They did also include quite significant sections of middle class people who voted for all sorts of people, people who had myths of empire, who missed of a past, who didn't like political correctness for all sorts of reasons. So I think there were ideological reasons as well as material reasons why people vote.
Adam?
No, I mean, you made a point in the opening thing about the language that socialists use, and it's true. It does come from the Chartists, wage slavery, abolition of the wages system, class, monopoly, which originally would have been monopoly of the landowners, and then it became monopoly of the factory owners, and. Yeah, it was a basic democratic demand. They expected that if they got the vote, and in fact not only them expected this, that they would use it to their advantage and to the disadvantage of the other class or classes. In fact, I don't know whether do you still have to study in university now, John Stuart Mill's representative government, because he actually says. If you have democracy, which everybody had a universal vote, the operating classes would establish class legislation. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that when they got the vote, they didn't establish class legislation. But also, I mean, I was born in Newport in South Wales. I'm going down there tomorrow for the by-election there. But of course, Newport was the scene of a Chartist uprising, and the mayor, John Frost, he was sent to Australia. When he came back, he was an old Tory. Yeah. it's so that there were other things that people were protesting about then. They were protesting mainly, I think, against the capitalist manufacturing and not mainly, but factories and that sort of thing. But as well as not having the vote.
I'll just say very briefly that, of course, political institutions are constructed through bad compromises among factions with power and not on the basis of any consistent set of moral values or principles, and anyone who tells you otherwise is making up a story to legitimate or defend a set of institutions.
Okay. Here, yes?
My question is, and if so, how do Corbyn and Sanders take up the task of Marxism?
What was the question for?
Corbyn and Sanders. Marxism.
Just because it came up, it's come up in the discussion or the opening remarks from a couple
of times. Anyone? Benjamin?
Well, it requires assembling a relatively large coalition of support, either within the European Union or among U.S. states and senators and representatives from U.S. states, to enact policies which gradually over time prepare us for a different situation. I don't think that we are ready to make some kind of rapid transition at this particular time. We have a lot of political infrastructure building to go. We're not really there. But what it means is that you have a state that is ready and interested in going in a good direction when the conditions are right.
Adam?
Well, I mean, the Corbyn Labour Party isn't all that socialist. It's I mean, you can remember, we can remember, Harold Wilson and people like that. I mean, it's old Labour in a new form. And you call it, what's it called? Party capture. I think the Trotskyists used to call it entryism. Mm-hmm. And you're going into political parties like the Democratic Party in America and the Labour Party in Britain, which in fact are parties which support the present system. I mean, I came across some old 78 records of the Labour Party's political broadcast in the 1929 general election. You've got one of their leaders, J.H. Thomas, who also came from Newport, saying he's speaking on the empire, and he's saying the empire is in safe hands. It's in safe hands with the Labour Party. So, if in fact
the institutional scheme has completely changed since then, utterly different, not at all similar in any way, shape, or form.
If in fact there was a Corbyn McDonald government, they would come up against, like you said, globalization. They would try to spend money on social reforms and making gradual progress towards, I don't know, towards state capitalism, in fact. And they would come unstuck because they would be elected to govern a capitalist system or the capitalist economy. And we've seen Labour governments before. We've seen the Wilson governments in Callaghan, we've seen Blair, and you can go back like that. We've seen social democratic governments in other countries. And they haven't been able to reform the capitalist system gradually into something else. They've ended up as managers of the capitalist system. And it's the wrong route to go down.
I don't think there is an alternative route.
Well, I was just going to say, I think if you just look back to the history of the Labour Party and you think about what happened after the Second World War, it was always deeply divided. There were those who thought that the reforms of the welfare state were potentially transformational, that they were reforms which could be built on and the next Labour government would go further and they would show the possibilities of public ownership of the commanding heights and so on. And there was always a very different trend, which thought enough's enough, we've made a few reforms, that's quite enough. We saw how since then the situation has changed absolutely dramatically. The manifesto that Labour fought the last election on is not a socialist programme. It's a very correct programme, I think, because it's about trying to claw back some of the damage that has been done in the Thatcher and the New Labour era. That doesn't mean that there are not possibilities for organising not just in the Labour Party and trying to deal with the kind of parliamentary Labour Party that we've got, which has all these people parachuted in, right-wingers parachuted in, but outside, because clearly a political party is not going to be much stronger than the kind of movement that there is outside, which has to be an informed and determined movement that does know where it's going.
James?
They're both Marxists, by the way. They both come from Marxist traditions. Might not be good Marxists, but, I don't think anybody is a good Marxist. There's no test. The question is, and are they good leftists? I don't know. Bernie Sanders seems all right, and Jeremy Corbyn's a lovely guy.
Your MP, is
he? He's my MP, and he came to my book launch a few years ago. He's a perfectly a selfless and a charming guy. Did a great thing. We had a neighbour who was being had her windows broken in. She was it was kind of a race attack around the 2003 Gulf War. We went to every single office, the police, we talked to the local council, which was a Labour council, and we talked to everybody. Everybody said there's nothing we can do about it, and we knocked on Jeremy Corbyn's door, and in about a day he'd sorted out somewhere else to move. He's without doubt, he's on the side of the angels as in his behaviour. I think as a leader he's been utterly useless. I mean, like, really off the chart useless. And I can't blame him personally for it, because I think he's in a really weird position, which is he's got a party, and this is going to, this blows my mind. They're very left-wing, you know, I don't mean the MPs, I think the newer members of the Labour Party are very, very left-wing, and very, very middle class. I mean, like, it's an intriguing political situation. They're mulishly hostile and indifferent to their working class supporters, who they characterise as racists and bigots at every opportunity. And they're snobs, and they imagine themselves tremendously left wing. But they really hate working class people, who they treat with disdain and disrespect, and that's why it's a London party. It's a London-based party. London, the richest part of the world, richest part of the country, and it's going to blow up, you know. And you can see it in the two-faced, lying, divided tongue the Labour Party addresses. You know, they say one thing in the north of England, they say another thing in the south of England, and it's certainly true that Mrs May has had a disastrous 3 years, but I don't think Jeremy Corbyn's had a brilliant 3 years. I think he's been seen to be somebody who's lied this way and lied that way by misrepresenting it himself over and over again, and symptomatically failing to do what they said they would do in their manifesto. I know you know that I'm going to say it. Respect the outcome of the referendum. Leave the European Union. There's no ambiguity in the word no. You know, it's in or out. You know, but what do you think, people? Should we be in or out? It'd be like if I put a referendum now. Do you think we should be in the room or out of the room? And you vote, all vote, yeah, let's get out of the room. And then somebody says, but what do you mean by out? I mean, it's out, isn't it? How simple is it? So if you respect the referendum, you leave the room. That's it. You leave the European Union.
We've got another 15 minutes, James, thinks, in the room.
Okay.
At the back there.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. This question is kind of pointed towards James, but it's open to everybody.
I'm just the most argumentative.
I believe you said something about I'm sorry, I'm not aware if you're a socialist or not. I'm not totally sure.
I don't know either.
Okay. You said the task of a new radical or socialist project is to engage with kind of consciousness that exists today, the kind of discussions that are happening today. And you said Marxist categories are obsolete or not relevant anymore. I'm kind of wondering if you think either Marx was wrong or his analysis or diagnosis of the problem is no longer relevant, or you think he's maybe just forgotten, and that's why we don't talk about these things today.
I don't think any idea is entirely free of its time. You know, all ideas are come out of the soil of their time, and the resonance they have beyond, I think, it depends on how deep they went. And how well they work in describing back to us our social conditions. What I've dread is that the actual course, the history of Marxism, is that it would turn into kind of boring academic, and also the language of some really not very pleasant bureaucratic elites, mostly in Eastern Europe, which is to say language of a ruling class, in which case, you know, Marxism mostly became a kind of dead language. And it's very hard for people not to hear it that way. I mean, I think I understand that it's different if you're younger and you had no experience of the Cold War and of the kind of corruption of, I mean, let's say corruption of Marxism in the mouths of both Labour Party and Communist Party people. But I've taught students who come from East Europe, and I know basically kind of blown away by the fact that they're being addressed in categories, which are the categories in which their parents were imprisoned and oppressed. And that we think that that's somehow liberatory. And I don't think you can have this pristine Marxism that somehow has survived the horrors of the Cold War, you know, that somehow is not implicated, you know, in the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Of course, you can keep the little flame of this particular language alive, but that's only to the extent that you ignore the fact that everybody else associates the nationalisation of the means of, or the socialisation of the means of production, with a kind of Stalinist regime, or, you know, not brilliant social welfare system in Britain. And that's why the language is dead. And we need to, I think we're missing out on the fact that there are real struggles happening here now. You know, that the referendum campaign is a real social struggle happening there now. The Gilets Jaunes is a real social struggle. But they might involve a lot more people than do trade union activities or pickets and all these things. They're actual, I wouldn't say revolutions, but they're rebellions. And this is the social question of our time. And we need to be eliciting from that ways to tell back to that movement its story from its own terms, so that it can hear and recognise itself.
Adam? I mean, I would only call myself a Marxist, so as to show I'm not opposed to Marx, but when you think of it, even the term Marxist is contrary to the Marx's own materialist conception of history. It's attributing the theory of socialism to one particular person. I think Marx supposed to have said on one occasion that he wasn't a Marxist. But I mean, historically, okay. I mean, there's been two trends of Marxism. There's been a sort of the social democratic German Social Democratic Party. That's that sort of trend, and then there's been the distortion which Lenin introduced into it. And okay, it's true. If you talk about Marxism, well, I remember to confirm what you said about people from Eastern Europe. It was one anniversary. We were selling a copy of some pamphlet on Marx outside the Natural History Museum, I think. All these people come from South Europe, you know, the Italians, the Spanish, and the Greeks. Oh, yes, buy it. But people that come from Poland and Hungary, they think this is we're supporters of the people that oppress them. I mean, that's the cross we have to bear, being socialists they've dragged the name of socialism and Marxism through the mud in Eastern Europe. I mean, you could be right. We have this discussion. Should we? If somebody asks you, are you a socialist, and you say, no, you have to say, what do you mean by socialism? I'm talking about YouTube. I'm a dinosaur. I just speak in Hyde Park, and you have to spend all your time there explaining what socialism isn't. It's not kibbutzim, it's not common ownership, it's not Clause 4, it's not Labour Party, it's not Russia, it's not government ownership. And what should we talk about instead? What should we call this new society, alternative to capitalism? You know, call it post-capitalist society or something like that. But I see that incidentally that the word communism is coming back in again. There's people writing books on fully automated luxury communism and things like that, and they don't mean by communism what's supposed to have existed in state capitalist Russia. But the other point is, I think the categories which Marx analysed history and society in are still valid. You can't still talk about class and relationship of, what can I say? Can I say productive resources? If I can't say means of
no,
production.
No, I'm not saying, I don't want to police the language. I'm just saying, are the words working?
No.
You know, are they hooking on? Are they?
No, you can explain the thing in you can explain the concept in a different language. But are you objecting to the concept? You're objecting to the concept or just to the language?
I think the concepts are not entirely adequate.
Okay. Mike?
I'd just like to throw in one other thing that I'm very preoccupied about at the moment, and when we talk about different kinds of movements, and that's the growth of far-right populism. I'll just leave it there.
Benjamin, you can...
Get nothing in regards to that particular question.
Okay. Let's see. One at the back there?
Yeah. Sorry to bring up an example again, but on Brexit, there definitely was people talking about trade, and there definitely was people talking about sovereignty and democracy, but predominantly back home in Newcastle especially, that's where it was this time the referendum, people were almost exclusively in pubs or in public talking about immigration. That's almost all I ever heard people talking about in person. Occasionally see a different headline, but that was predominantly the discourse. Do you think there's any way that democracy can avoid becoming subject to populism, or think it's an inevitable trend? And if you do think there's a way that we can avoid destructive populist rhetoric or disingenuous populist rhetoric becoming part of populism, and what way becoming part of democracy, what way would that be?
Benjamin?
Sure. Well, I think that populism in many cases is a healthy response to rampant technocracy, rampant imposition by a false expert class of an economic policy that hurts people, that where there's no moral argument for it. And so sometimes you need a little bit of populism as a response to that, and it's in part because, as the gentleman has pointed out, the left is very bad at talking in a popular kind of way, that right-wing populism predominates over left-wing populism. Since the question brought up the European Union, and I have not really talked about the European Union today, I will say this much about Brexit. Firstly, while people may have voted to walk out of this room, they sure as heck didn't vote to walk into a free trade agreement with the United States, which is precisely what the right plans to do. The right is very, very dedicated to doing that. And of course, that was never submitted to a vote, nor will it ever be submitted to a vote. And furthermore, there's a false notion here that there can be any kind of self-determination, or that there is some kind of primordial British people that pre-exists the state. This is a kind of Schmittian bullshit, where you claim that there's a primordial people that precedes the state, and they give themselves a political system, and then they go, oh, see, it represents us in some kind of thick way. And this is based on some theologized, nationalistic conception of the people as primordial. And it's completely false, and it's intrinsically right-wing. And it's something that ought to be completely rejected by anyone on the left. And any time I hear anybody invoke the language of self-determination, I go Carl Schmitt immediately. And that's what, unfortunately, we're having here. We're having people make appeals to a notion of a primordial England, a primordial British people that pre-exists the state. And then they go, well, this group of people don't feel that the European Union is representative of them, so they have some kind of self-determination right to revoke. This language misses completely what is really at stake here. What is really at stake here is that you live in a world where the nation state has become weak, especially the European nation state. It's too small to functionally exist on its own. It needs to be embedded in some kind of bloc. That bloc needs to operate in a way that is not horrifying. The European Union currently operates in a pretty horrifying way. That needs to be reformed. If you pull out of it, you can't go it alone. You end up in a different bloc. The only bloc that is as large, which the UK could realistically join, is an American bloc, in which it goes into a free trade agreement with the United States and then becomes functionally an American colony. That is what people voted for, and they don't realize it. Because that will annihilate the British welfare state, British public services. It will be absolutely disastrous. And to say, well, it's what the primordial people want because we held a referendum, I think entirely misses the point.
Okay, look, I've got to, because first off, I think, you know, pretty much every single word, you know, and the included, was utterly wrong and ludicrous.
You're on your own on this panel, you know.
I'm glad, because I think this is worthwhile. First off, you know, I think you utterly... fetishize the international trade, because what you're saying to us is there is no alternative You're saying there is no alternative. You cannot buck the system. You cannot buck the market.
But if you're saying socialism in one country.
Well, I am saying socialism in one country. I don't mind saying that. Because
it's making that explicit.
Well, absolutely, I want to make it explicit. Because with Hannah Arendt, I would say it's impossible to have a world politics. It's impossible to do politics at the level of the world. What social system, what polity could one conceive of disputing and debating over? I don't think it's possible to reform the European Union, because there isn't a European polity in which people participate. There is, you don't know, who the finance minister in Italy is. You don't know what the Dutch foreign minister has said. You don't read the Slovakia newspaper.
That's saying we can't reform Austria-Hungary because it's run by a Habsburg emperor.
Is it
these
all right?
Things happen.
Would it be all right if I carried on?
You can.
Yeah, thank you. So what I'm saying is that, well, you could reform it if there was a European polity, if there was a European republic, if there was a European people engaged in a singular argument, then those people would be in a position to enforce or impose their will upon the thing. But as it's not the case, what you will have is a set of people's technocrats subvert what is a conceivable polity, which is a British polity, not because it's primordial or anything like that. It just happens to be where the political institutions have fallen, and that within that, you can have an election in which you participate. The European Union election will take place, I guess. And there is no debate, and you don't know who your Euro MEP is, and you don't follow the debates in the European Parliament because it's not a parliament. Anybody who's attended the European Parliament understands no issues are properly argued or decided because it couldn't be a parliament, because there is no European people holding them to account. Now, you can call that primordial and you can say populist or right wing. I don't care. I've been called a fascist for 30 years. When I've campaigned to get the British troops out of Ireland, people said I was an IRA fascist. When I campaigned against the war in Iraq, they said, oh, you're a Saddam Hussein fascist. I'm so over that. Do you know what? People in Britain, mostly 90%, are white. Whoa, get over it, man. That's where white people come from. It's not a revelation. That's why people in Britain are the colour they are. It's not racist for those people to want to control their country.
On the basis of whiteness?
No, on the basis that they are the citizens of that country.
Marge?
No, I'm not going to engage with that. Okay. I'm sorry.
Adam?
I'm really not. I'm just going to say that I think you're raising a very, very important question about how you do engage with that. And I don't think, obviously, I just said that political education was very important, and I believe it is, but it's not just about that. And we all know perfectly well that telling people they're wrong is normally pretty counterproductive. So we do really have to understand that there's a lot of emotion here. People feel angry, people feel alienated for very good reasons, and that, of course, is founded, but that doesn't mean it's not there, the anger and the alienation and the kind of... I think psychosocial approaches are really helpful here in trying to understand the interconnections between people's feelings and emotions and the kind of moods of the times and actually the circumstances in which we're living. So I think we absolutely have to find ways of engaging with those feelings and engaging... I mean, just one very simple example. I think the campaign... to kick football, to kick racism out of football is a good example, and sadly only too necessary. I think we made progress, and if I'm not made progress at all. But those kind of campaigns do engage with people's feelings and passions, as well as trying to engage with some of the very negative aspects of their feelings.
Adam?
we must keep on discussing Brexit. I can remember the previous referendum in 1975, and James's case for Lexit was then the official position of the of most of the Labour Party, and it was the same thing. You know, Tony Benn and people going on about sovereignty and democracy, and we want to be able to construct it wasn't socialism, but you know. A national state capitalism on our own and things like that. I mean, these even then it didn't make sense. But if you've still got about three or four Labour MPs who are still on autopilot from 1975, you know, Dennis Skinner and a couple of others, and they vote consistently, with the Tories. But to come to populism. It's true, you know, populism has got the wind behind it at the moment. I mean, talking about this by-election in Newport, there are 11 candidates, about four or five of them are small splinter groups off of UKIP. Now, in the 1970s, you'd have had 11 candidates, but there'd have been the International Marxist Group, the Socialist Workers' Party, so things have changed. But. I suppose the only populist leader, I hope you're not going to say it will be Tommy Robinson. The other people, Boris Johnson, a populist from the lower class. Nigel Farage. No, these people, Trump. He's a capitalist. I mean, they're politicians who are exploiting the popular mood to get elected or to further their careers. I see in the papers they claim that Trump didn't expect to be elected and Boris Johnson didn't expect to win the referendum. But anyway, they've stirred up this thing and they can.
Okay. Obviously, join me in giving a very warm thank you to all of our panelists.
I'm just going to. I've got to say at the start. Please take free copies of the Platypus Review, which many different issues there. And Adam's also brought some literature from the Socialist Party of Great Britain. You tend to negotiate a trade deal with him. We will be going to the New Cross House for a drink. Please do join us. And thanks for coming.
What's the New Cross House?
Oh, it's a pub.
It's a pub?
Yeah.
Which one is that?
We wanted to go to the Marcus of
Jones. No, one.
Might be no. Might be no.
It took you how long since I've been for drinking.
No, it's,
I've never been in a Marcus of Jones. Honestly, I don't know what it's like, but it's very colourful on the outside.
Yeah.
You know, Laurie Grove, it's the
yeah,
ones.
Yeah, is it the one on the corner of Laurie Grove?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll go with the democracy vote.
What's it called? You cross something.
No, I think it's. Mark said the working class must constitute itself. The working people have no country. The working class must constitute itself. Political power is exists in a national form.
What do you do with the Welsh nationalists and the Scottish nationalists?
Well, look. If the Scots won their independence,
Spanish
but it seems that they're very different. They were asked, and if they had a right.
Yeah. Actually, there's the one candidate standing in Newport is called Polish the Welsh Assembly.
Well, that would be popular. Welsh regionalism is strong, and I think, Welsh Scottish Welsh. More really
regional.